In 1992, readers of Newsweek magazine had an opportunity to read in the science section an article entitled "The Handwriting of God." And subscribers to Time magazine could read a cover story called "What Does Science Tell Us About God?" An American astrophysicist named George Schmidt had held a press conference. There, he announced the results of data gathered by a Cosmic Background Explorer satellite. Schmidt's team of researchers had detected slight but persistent fluctuations in the universe's cosmic background radiation. He believed that these are echoes of the Big Bang, echoes of the moment of creation of the universe. Then, at the press conference, he said something that led to all the attention. He said, "If you are religious, this is like looking at God." In an interview, Schmidt elaborated on the statement, "It really is like finding the driving mechanism for the universe. And isn't that what God is? What matters is the science. I want to leave it to the religious, or want to leave the religious implications to theologians and to each person, and to let them see how the findings fit into their idea of the universe." Now, Dr. George Schmidt was suggesting that an uncontrolled explosion would result in a perfectly even cosmic background radiation. The fluctuations in the background radiation led him to suggest that there might be an intentionality, a control, a grand design behind the Big Bang. Well, as a minister, I feel it is my responsibility to investigate this. If science has found proof for the existence of God, it's part of my job as the role of as your minister to pass the news on to all of you. So I studied the articles that followed the headlines. I found that skeptics argued that the discovery of fluctuations in cosmic background radiation is not proof of the existence of God. The skeptics said that slight differences in background radiation only suggest that the Big Bang was not a perfectly uniform explosion. The skeptics argued that this is an interesting discovery. However, it is not necessarily the handwriting of God. Scientists observe many explosions, they say, that are not perfectly uniform. Intelligent beings do not control most of these uneven explosions. Skeptics argue that the fluctuations neither prove nor disapprove the theory that there is a grand master plan for the universe that went into the Big Bang. They argue that adequate scientific evidence still does not exist to prove or disprove the existence of God. The modern involvement of physicists in religion dates to Copernicus. Around 1512, this Polish astronomer sent a paper about the structure of our planetary system to several acquaintances. The Earth, he wrote, his acquaintances, orbits around the sun. It was a revolutionary idea which questioned the foundations of religious teachings. 100 years passed before the Catholic Church became aware of this threat to their dogma. Then the church leadership directed their full force against the man who was at that time the strongest advocate of this new astronomy, a teacher named Galileo. Following Copernicus's lead, Galileo presented evidence supporting the view that the Earth, in fact, orbited around the sun. He was a highly respected celebrity. Galileo sometimes gave lectures to more than 2,000 students. His fame reached new heights in 1609 when he built a telescope and he made sensational observations with it. Now, he wasn't looking into people's windows. He was looking at the planet Jupiter, and he saw that Jupiter had four moons, and these moons changed positions every night. Therefore, one could conclude that they moved in orbits around the planet, which meant that Jupiter was smaller, a smaller likeness of our own solar system, that the Earth moved around the Sun the way these moons moved around Jupiter. Even stronger evidence that the Earth orbited the Sun was found in the fact that with the telescope, Galileo could see phases of Venus. To the naked eye, Venus had always presented itself as bright and unchanging. But looking through the telescope, Galileo could see Venus pass through various phases of different brightnesses from narrow crescent to full disk, just as our moon does. Catholic Church leaders compelled Galileo to journey to Rome in 1633 to stand trial. He was found guilty of having held and taught the Copernican doctrine, and he was ordered to recant. Faced with the possibility of torture, Galileo recited a formula in which he cursed and detested his past errors. The court nevertheless sentenced him to prison, but the Pope changed the penalty just to house arrest, and Galileo remained under house arrest for the last 8 years of his life. Now, the men who created this split between science and religion, astronomers like Copernicus and Galileo, they did not believe that their discoveries contradicted proofs of God's existence. For these scientists, a world with the sun at its center was no less godly than one centered around the earth. Copernicus believed that he had discovered evidence of God's divine harmony. Galileo believed his discoveries gave people a better understanding of the divine order of the universe. Isaac Newton, who discovered the laws of gravity that govern the movement of the universe, was also still convinced that it was God who created these laws. Newton wrote, "The most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." Still, church leaders were slow to update their theology and adopt it to the latest scientific findings. For many people, 400 years ago, starting 400 years ago, this new scientific discovery inaugurated an age of enlightenment, emphasizing reason and scientific method. In the 19th century, the Unitarian Marie Mitchell was the first woman astronomer and was the first professor of astronomy at Vassar College and the first director of Vassar's observatory. Marie Mitchell was one of the most celebrated American scientists of the 19th century. About the relationship between science and religion, this Unitarian said, "Scientific investigations push on, and will reveal new ways in which God works and bring us deeper revelations of the holy unknown." But she said that the revelations of the Bible and understanding of nature through science are not in conflict. "If they seem to be," she said, "it is because you do not understand the Bible, or you do not understand science, or both." In the first half of the 20th century, the most famous physicist was Albert Einstein. Raised in a Jewish family, Einstein was occasionally asked about his religious beliefs. At one place he wrote, "A scientist's religious feeling takes the form of a rapturous amazement at the harmony of natural law, which reveals an intelligence of such superiority that compared with it, all the systematic thinking and acting of human beings is an utterly insignificant reflection. Now, it's a pretty long sentence, but notice he doesn't use the word God. He talks about natural law revealing an intelligence of superiority. He didn't like the word God. Einstein didn't. He felt that the word God linked too closely to the idea of a God with human features and a human mentality. Such an idea of God for Einstein was incompatible with scientific knowledge. He saw the image of God as an old man in the sky, as a relic from the past. He believed that if we could say farewell to that bearded white guy in the clouds, we would eliminate any reason for hostility between religion and science. Einstein wrote, "A knowledge of the existence of something we cannot penetrate." Now, he's talking about the limits of the human mind and the human perception. "A knowledge of the existence of something we cannot penetrate, of the manifestations of the profoundest reason and the most radiant beauty, which are only accessible to our reason in their most elementary forms. It is this knowledge and this emotion that constitute the true religious attitude. In this sense, and in this alone, I am a deeply religious man." Now, another physicist who holds ideas about religion and God that are very similar to Einstein's is a man named Paul Davies. Originally, Davies was born and went to school in England. Then he spent some time in Adelaide, Australia, teaching at the university there, which is where I first heard his name. And then eventually he accepted a position at Arizona State University, which happens to be where I took my one class in physics in 1969, and received a D. But Paul Davies is a physicist who explores this whole area of religion and physics. He is now the director of the Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science at Arizona State University. And in his book, God and the New Physics, Davies wrote that in looking at the fundamental constraints of nature, there is evidence for a grand design. By fundamental constants, he writes, physicists mean certain qualities that play a basic role in physics and which have the same numerical value everywhere in the universe and at all moments in time. For example, an atom of hydrogen is the same in a distant star as it is on Earth. It has the same size, mass, and internal electric charges. Gravitational force, he writes, is another fundamental constant. If it were slightly different, stars like our sun would not exist. If the values of such fundamental constants were only slightly different, it would change the structure of our physical world. Only a very small shift in fundamental constants would cause a drastic change in the structure of the universe, and life as we know it could not exist. He goes on, "The numerical constants could be regarded as evidence of design. The delicate fine-tuning in the value of the constants might be attributed to God. It is hard to resist the impression that the present structure of the universe, apparently so sensitive to minor alterations on the numbers, has been rather carefully thought out. The seemingly miraculous concurrence of numerical values that nature has assigned to her fundamental constants must remain the most compelling evidence for an element of cosmic design." Now, Einstein had said, a physicist's religious feeling takes the form of a rapturous amazement at the harmony of natural law. Davies says, the seemingly miraculous concurrence of numerical values that nature has assigned to her fundamental constants must remain the most compelling evidence for an element of cosmic design. They both actually hate the word God and avoid using it. In the second half of the 20th century, and now at the beginning of the 21st century, the most famous physicist is Stephen Hawking. Jesuits invited Stephen Hawking to the Vatican in 1981 to give a lecture at a conference on modern cosmology. Hawking wrote, at the end of the conference, participants were granted an audience with Pope John Paul II. He told us that it was all right to study the evolution of the universe after the Big Bang, but we should not inquire into the Big Bang itself, because that was the moment of creation and therefore the work of God. Hawking goes on, I was glad then that he did not know the subject of the talk I had just given at the conference. The possibility that space-time was finite but had no boundary, which means that it had no beginning, no moment of creation. I had no desire, Hawking said, I had no desire to share the fate of Galileo, with whom I felt a strong sense of identity, partly because of the coincidence of having been born exactly 300 years after his death. In 1988, Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time, was on the bestseller list for many months. I do not think this popularity reflected a sudden awakening of public interest in physics. Instead, I suspect the interest in Hawking's book expressed a religious longing for a new worldview. Hawking believed physics can develop a unified theory of nature. He concluded his book with this sentence, "If we get a final theory, it will be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we will know the mind of God." Part of Hawking's celebrity is no doubt because of his strength in the face of physical adversity. He's now 72 years old. He was first diagnosed with ALS in 1963 when he was 21. On average, people with ALS live 3 years after diagnosis, but that's on average. That means that half the people live longer than 3 years, and a few people, like Stephen Hawking, live for a long time. All of us are fragile creatures. We only live a short time. We are limited to one small planet. However, we dare to hope that we can have the intelligence and the imagination that we can grasp the physics of the universe. Hawking symbolizes this hope that with our physical limits, we might comprehend the nature of reality. In his 2010 book, The Grand Design, Hawking says something similar to Paul Davies. He wrote, "Our universe and its laws appear to have a design that both is tailor-made to support us and, if we are to exist, leaves little room for alteration. This is not easy to explain and raises the natural question of why it is that way." Well, his answer, he says, the answer lies with a theory that he created in this book. He calls it the M theory. Now, the book is somewhat ambiguous as to what M stands for. At some places, he talks about the master theory. So M may stand for master. Other places, he talks about the miracle theory. So M may stand for miracle. And still other places, he talks about the mystery theory. So it may stand for mystery. The book's not clear. He could have used an editor to clarify that. But the vital point here is that the M theory allows for the existence of 18 dimensions of space and time. And so this is really a variation of the superstring theory, which physicists started to develop in 1984. Superstring theory is an attempt to link quantum physics to the theory of general relativity to develop a unified theory of nature. String theory physicists say that the theory holds out the promise that we can really understand questions about how the universe began and questions of why the universe is the way it is. For the equations that describe superstring theory to work, physicists need to use additional dimensions. So Hawking speaks of 11 dimensions. Well, how do we test this theory? Some hope that the Large Hadron Collider will be able to detect quantum gravity and prove that superstring theory is, in fact, correct. It hasn't so far. However, some physicists don't think that this will ever be proven. They're skeptical of superstring theory. One, Lawrence Krauss, who also teaches at Arizona State University, where I got the D in physics, with Paul Davies. Lawrence Krauss writes, "No theoretical picture has so successfully permeated the consciousness of the physics community," he's talking about superstring theory, "without having yet demonstrated its ability to successfully resolve a single experimental mystery about nature." So he thinks it's a fad and it will fade. We will see. What do physicists think about God? In my small survey, there does, to me, appear to be a sort of consensus. Before the 20th century, Copernicus, Galileo, Newton, and Mitchell all agreed that physics and astronomy simply revealed the way God works. But Albert Einstein in the 20th century strongly disliked the word God and instead spoke of a religious feeling that takes the form of a rapturous amazement at the harmony of natural law, which reveals an intelligence of such superiority that compared with it, all the systematic thinking and acting of human beings is an utterly insignificant reflection. I've read that 3 times. You can see how important it is to me. As thinking and acting of human beings is insignificant. We can't really understand this. We only have a hint of knowledge of the harmony and the nature of the universe. Out in Arizona, Paul Davies also dislikes the word God, prefers not to use it. But like Einstein, he believes that there is a rational and intelligible scheme of things that we uncover through scientific investigation. Stephen Hawking also does not like the word God, a common theme among physicists, but he does argue for the M theory, the mystery or miracle theory that includes 11 dimensions of space and time. And what about George Schmidt, the fellow we started with who found the cosmic background radiation variations? Well, in 2007, George was awarded the Nobel Prize for his discovery. And an interviewer asked him, "What possessed you in that press conference back in 1992? What possessed you to use the God word when you announced your findings?" And Schmidt said, "I invoked God because it's a cultural icon people understand. But there's something deeper. Talking about cosmology, you can't help make the connection to religion. In all religions, all cultures, there's always a beginning, always in the beginning." Well, it's a fantastic time to be alive, isn't it? I've given 3 sermons. 100 years ago, we didn't even know that DNA existed. But 2 weeks ago, I was able to talk about the possibility of a gene that helps determine that we have a religious impulse and an interest in religion. The human genome has been completed in just a short period of human history. We had no way of scanning brains 100 years ago. Now we have various brain scans that allow us to look at the brain activity when we are in prayer or when we are in meditation. We have ways of studying this, and we know more about how our brain works, and we're learning more each day. And we have today the Hadron Collider in Switzerland. We have the Hubble telescope orbiting above us. Each day, we learn more about the nature of life and the nature of the universe. It is such an amazing, wonderful, exciting time to be alive and to be open to new knowledge and to be interested in the nature of the universe.